Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our final installment in the question of Heresy 101 and Rabbinic Responses. And just to kind of recap the direction we have gone in thus far in this series. So in the first shiur, we talked about essentially biblical criticism of the documentary hypothesis, and fundamentally recognizing that it does come from a place of rigor. It does come from, a sensible place in the sense that we cannot just point at it and say, it's heresy, we don't like it, it must be wrong, it's foolish. No, it is serious. And that it's something we should not just automatically dismiss. And then in that shiur, we also looked at very, very briefly, just scratched a little bit beneath the surface of a few different figures, rabbinic figures who have grappled with the documentary hypothesis with biblical criticism in a few different ways. Again, some have kind of outright attacked, challenged it. Others have been perhaps a slightly more defensive posture. But what we talked about in the last shiur was how we need to adopt an entirely different mindset. And that when it comes to the challenge of biblical criticism, it almost affords us an opportunity to ask a slightly different question, which is, what do we actually believe? Right? What does Judaism actually have to say about the Torah? And what should be stressed is there's no world in which there's complete 100% kind of synchronicity between, right, biblical criticism and Jewish thought, right? There's obviously no world in which the two are actually going to be in agreement. But nonetheless, it is worth recognizing and realizing that there is at least some of the challenge, some of this challenge comes from the fact that we have such an unsophisticated view of the Torah. We have just such a simple perspective on what it means when we speak of the Torah, that it does not make it any easier for us to grapple with biblical criticism when we can't even have a slightly more complicated understanding of the Torah itself. And so we spent the last year talking in detail about the word Torah itself. And when you look in the Torah about the word Torah, we start to see that there's just so many complicated perspectives on what exactly it means. There's so many different ways of trying to understand exactly what the word itself means that that in and of itself is noteworthy. And what I want to turn to tonight, and really look at what I would say is some of the most intense and extreme articulations on this perspective, is to try to ask several fundamental questions about the basics of Jewish theology when it comes to the giving of the Torah. For those of you who were at BIEV a few years ago on Shavuot afternoon, some of these sources will be familiar because I spoke about this topic then, but tonight we're going to flesh this out even more. And there's actually a very important question we need to begin by asking, which is, when we say God gave Moshe the Torah at Har Sinai, right, literally just last week's parasha, what was given? Right, there is this common understanding. There is this typical understanding if you approach someone in the street, as it were, and you ask them this question, right? They might say just uncritically, well, the entire Torah was given, which obviously raises a lot of theological questions. Wait a second, the entire Torah was given? Sefer Vayikra was given before it happened, right? The entirety of Sefer Shemot was given before it happened. What exactly was given? What, when we say the Torah was given at Har Sinai, what was given? Or to frame it ever so slightly differently, when was the Torah written? Right? The classic understanding is it was just all given, right? The classic kind of unthinking answer is it was just all given at Har Sinai. However, as we see, that is never a suggestion made by the Gemara itself. So now if we turn to our sources and we take a look at source number one. And it's the Gemara in Gittin. And the Gemara in Gittin tells us the following. Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Bena'a. Torah, Megillah, Megillah Nitna. The Torah was given Megillah Megillah. It was given part by part, Shnei Emar, and then they just quote a verse, which I skipped out because, eh. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish Omer, Torah Chatuma Nitna. It was given complete, Shnei Emar. Right? What do these two terms mean? What does this debate mean? That the Torah was given Megillah Megillah or the Torah was given Chatuma? Right? So Rashi here explains. Source number 2a, Megillah Megillah Nitna, Kishne Emra Parasha Lamosha. When Moshe was taught a given parasha, a given unit of the Torah, Haya Kotva, then he would write it down. Ulibsof Araboim Shana, at the end of the 40 years, Kishe Nigmaru Kola Parashiot, Chivran Begidin Vitafran, right? He sewed them all together. In other words, how was the Torah given? Well, it wasn't all given at Har Sinai, no. What happened? Right, let's ignore for a second the question of, well, what exactly is given at Har Sinai? But let's talk about, and next week we will start reading Parashat Truma. So per Megillah Megillah Nitna, what happens is, right, Parashat Truma is instructed, right? God tells Moshe, right, this is what you're going to do. And Moshe went off and he wrote down, right, this is what God just said to me to do, right? That's how... Through the process of the 40 years, right, Moshe Rabbeinu would write down all of these scraps of Torah, as it were, all of these scraps of parashiot, all of these stories, all of these laws, all of these narratives. And at the end of the 40 years, he gathered them all together and he made them all into one single document. The alternative view, Chatuma Nitna, what does it mean when we say the Torah was given complete? Rashi explains again in 2b, Lo nichtava ad sof arba'im. It was not completed, it was not written until the end of the 40 years. La'achar she'ne'emru kol ha'parashiyot kulan, until all the parashiyot had been given. In other words, right, Moshe was told everything, right, but didn't write any of it down, right, and only at the end of the 40 years, at the very, very end of his life, did he decide to commit it all down to writing? So what about all the things that happened earlier in the first year and the second year? What happened there? V'hanne emrot lo she'bishana rishana ushnia. And when it came to the things that were taught to him in the first and second years, hayu sedorot lo alpe ad shekatvan, right? They made sure they were preserved orally until they could be written down. Crucially, what's for us, what's important to extract from here is whatever the answer may be, the debate between the Gemara is solely whether Moshe wrote the Torah as they went along in the 40 years, or whether he wrote it all down at the end of 40 years. Right? There is never the suggestion that, right, Sefer Vayikra was given before Sefer Vayikra happened. Sefer Bamidbar happened before Sefer Bamidbar. Sefer Bamidbar was given before Sefer Bamidbar happened. Right? It is a classic, I would say, myth that is casually perpetuated within the Jewish world, that we assume when we say God gave Moshe the Torah at Har Sinai, we mean Chamisha Chumshei Torah, all five books, despite the fact that they hadn't yet happened. No. Chazal are clear and unequivocal, right? The process of the Torah coming to be might be either Megillah Nitna or Chatuma Nitna, but either way, there was a process involved. And what is interesting is, when we think of especially this first opinion of Megillah Megillah Nitna, that the Torah was written part by part, right, certain verses within the Torah actually become slightly more interesting. So a couple of weeks ago, we read at the very, very end of Parashat Bishalach, Amalek attacks, after which Hashem says, source number 3, Vayoma Hashem el Moshe ketov zot zikaron basefer. V'simba ozne Yoshua, write this down in a book, preserve it. And tell it to Yehoshua, ki machon chad zecha Amalek mitachat Hashem. We need to wipe out the memory of Amalek. But, right, Hashem literally tells Moshe, write this down. Well, if we think of Megillah, Megillah, Nitna as the process of the Torah being given, right, it kind of makes a lot more kind of a plot sense, as it were, right? Moshe is literally being instructed, right, make sure you get this down, write this down, put this in there, make a note of it, keep it. Similarly, we will read in this week's parasha, the very, very end of this week's parasha, Source number four, Vayichtov Moshe et kol divrei Hashem. Moshe wrote down all the commands of Hashem. Vayashkin babolka, vayivin zbet ha'chadah, shem esrei matzeva, shem esrei shavdei as well, fine. And then verse 7, vayikach sefer habrit. He takes the sefer of the covenant, vayikra bal zayanam, and he reads it to them. Vayomaru, and they say back to him, kol asher diber Hashem, na'aseh v'nishma. Right? The na'aseh v'nishma, so well known, so famous, is in reaction to a book or a something Moshe has written down at the behest of God, right? Literally, we see this writing process take place within the Torah itself. And one final example in Sefer Bamidbar, right? At the end of Parashat Maaseh, at the end of, in Parashat Maaseh, the very end of Sefer Bamidbar, right? It records the travels of the Jewish people. Eile Maaseh v'nei Yisrael asher yetzu me'eretz Mitzrayim l'sivotam b'yad Moshe v'Aaron. These were their marches. Vayichtov Moshe et motza'ehem l'maseihem al pi Hashem. Moshe wrote them down. Ve'eile Maaseh v'nei, and here they are. Right, again, right? The Torah makes reference multiple times to this idea that Moshe is writing something down, right? As part of the process of the Torah, right? Megillah Nitna, or, you know, Torah Chatuma Nitna, but this idea that the Torah, organically is completely the wrong word, but the Torah developed is also the wrong word, but the Torah was written during the process of the 40 years, right? In whichever way we determine the Gemara and Gittin, right, just seems to also just come clearly from the verses. However, there are a few key questions that emerge, even if we accept this. We've now defeated what I would say is the classic but incorrect understanding of the Torah's being given at Har Sinai. So the first question is, well, what exactly was given at Har Sinai? The second question is, given Moshe's role in the writing of the Torah, how much editorial license, as it were, did he have? And finally, and this is going to be something that we'll devote some time to, and it's probably one of the more interesting areas to ever discuss, what about the verses that seem to defy possibility to have ever been written by Moshe Rabbeinu himself? Right? How do we counter all, how do we understand all of those, you know, verses of which we will see many examples? But to begin, right, what was given at Har Sinai? Right? So I would say, right, once we accept the Gemara in Gittin, that everything that took place after the giving of the Torah was written during the time that the Jewish people wandered around in the wilderness, we are nonetheless, right, left to assume, well, then, everything before that, from Bereshit Bara Elokim until, ostensibly, Parashat Yitro, was given at Har Sinai. However, here, fascinatingly, there are a couple of midrashim that just casually drop, right? Don't even think for a second about the kind of the issues raised by this, but they casually drop an astonishing idea. And it's almost certainly sparked by, even though they don't explicitly say this, source number six, which is relatively near the beginning of Parashat Bereshit, right, chapter 5. And we say, Zesefer Toldot Adam, B'yom Bara Elokim Adam, B'dmut Elokim Asa Adam. This is the Sefer of the generations of Adam, of the generations of humanity. This is literally the book, right? Now, you could read that as almost introducing the idea of Sefer Bereshit as, right, a self-acknowledged book. Let's read the following midrashim, both of which are taken from, right, Shmot Rabbah, both of which are talking about Paro's oppression of the Jewish people. So the first one, right, comes when Moshe is upset with God for how his attempts to break the Jewish people out of slavery are going. Vayashav Moshe el Hashem, right, so this is the verse, right, Moshe went back to Hashem. Vayomer lama hariyata la'am hazeh, why are you doing this to this, to, why are you being so harsh to these people? Right, so what was it? Right, so this midrash wants to say, well, what was Moshe's argument? Right, what actually, like, that verse is just summarizing a broader conversation, a broader argument. What was that argument? Elakach amar lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is what Moshe said. Natalti sefer bereshit. I took sefer bereshit, v'karativo, and I read it. V'reiti ma'aseh shel dor haba, ha'mabul, ha'eich nidonu. I saw how you treated the generations of the flood, how you judged them. Midat hadin haita, you were just. U'ma'aseh hador haflaga, v'shal sedomim, ha'eich nidonu. Midat hadin haita, how you judged the Tower of Babel and also Sodom, and how there was an attribute of justice there too. Ha'am hazeh ma'asu shenisht abdu b'kol ha'dorot she'avru. What is it that these people, the Jews, deserve so much more harsh punishment than all these other people in Sefer Bereishit? Right? The Midrash itself I'm not particularly interested in, except for this just casual acknowledgement that Sefer Bereishit exists while the Jewish people live in Egypt. In other words, Sefer Bereishit is not given at Har Sinai, but rather no, Sefer Bereishit exists as some sort of book that Moshe perused while in Egypt, right? Long before the Jewish people had been released as slaves. Similarly, right, also from Shmot Rabbah, right, but in a slightly different location, a similar idea emerges when it comes to, again, Paro's oppression. Right, Al Kain Heim Tzoakim Leimor, therefore they cry, saying, and Paro says, Tichbat Havada Al Hashem, make the word harder on the people. Right, so Chazal derives something fascinating from here. What was it? What was it when Paro made their work worse for them? Mela made. From here we can learn, say Chazal. Shehayu v'yadam Megillot. The Jewish people owned Megillot, owned scrolls. In Egypt, Shehayu mishtashin bohem mishabbat l'shabbat. That they would delight in, they would enjoy, they would read from Shabbat to Shabbat. Lomar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Goalan, that testified to the fact that God would redeem them. Lefi Shehayu Nachin BaShabbat, because they rested on Shabbat. Amar Lahen Paro, thus Paro said, Tichbad Oda Al Anashim V'yasu Bava Al Yishu. Right, he insisted that the work be heavier, more intense, that there wouldn't be Yishu. What does that mean? Al Yehu Mishtashim Va'al Yehu Nefishim B'Yom HaShabbat. It basically stopped them from enjoying Shabbat. Now again, I don't want to get into the details of the Midrash, but this Midrash assumes the Jewish people are observing Shabbat, which is an idea testified to in Bereishit, right? And also that the Jewish people are reading every single Shabbat scrolls about Jewish Theology 101, right? That God will redeem them, right? It does not explicitly say here it's Sefer Bereishit like in the other Midrash. But Chazal don't seem particularly bothered by this idea that Sefer Bereishit exists outside of Matan Torah. That Sefer Bereishit existed as a work, as a sefer, even before Matan Torah. And this kind of opens up, right, it opens up a Pandora's box. It also opens up, I think, a very, very interesting area of exploration I don't want to get into, which is when we often deal with some of the stories, particularly earlier in Sefer Bereishit, right, there is something about the idea that it was consciously taken by God and included into the Torah that actually makes it even more interesting to explore the idea of Sefer Bereishit being ancient Near Eastern myths with a Jewish twist. Right, there's lots to say about that, but that is not for now. But again, there is this idea, right? Now we have potentially, and I should stress, right? I hope I will remember to stress this multiple times throughout the year, but given I've been going for 20 minutes and this is the first time, this might be the only time I make this announcement. I think there is always something incredibly important to stress in these kinds of shiurim, and I want to say it explicitly, right? Too often in these kinds of shiurim, someone will listen. Someone will be paying attention. And they will walk away and they will say two words to the effect of, today I learned that Judaism believes that Sefer Bereishit existed before the Torah was given. And that is the only understanding now that exists. That's not true, right? All of the sources in this shir, the Gemara in Gittin is the exception in the sense that it's the treatment of the topic. But a lot of these sources are selectively culled from 18,000 different possible sources that address this topic, and I'm intentionally choosing the sources that offer what I would say is the most interesting and complex perspective on the Torah's composition. And it's important to stress, there are a couple of sources. I forget if I remember to put them on the sheet. There's a lot of sources, by the way. We're only on number eight. There's a lot. And at a certain point, I had to start culling more and more and more. But I just want to stress this fact, right? There is a fundamental difference between I now know unequivocally that Judaism believes X versus there are some sources that open up the possibility that X isn't as outlandish as we first thought. To walk away from sources 7 and 8 with the belief that Sefer Bereshit was 100% definitely in existence before the Torah was given, wrong. However, to walk away knowing that it did that idea did not seem to bother Chazal in the Midrash and Shemot Rabbah, and thus opening up this really interesting intellectual possibility that Sefer Bereshit existed before the Torah was given. Yeah, that notion exists, even if, right, it's not necessarily the most mainstream. But again, the purpose is in part to try and understand and grapple with some of these more complex notions. With that, we have now, I would say, even more limited possibility of understanding the notion of the Torah's composition, right? For sure, Chazal, anything after the giving of the Torah at Har Sinai happened after the giving of the Torah at Har Sinai. But even again, Sefer Bereshit, we've seen, may have existed before the Torah was given. And, you know, the great question to ask is, though, I didn't see any sources pointing one way or another, right? Even the very, very beginning of Shemot, which does describe slavery, which does describe these things. Like, at which point, you know, could they have been given? When we talk about the Torah being given at Har Sinai, right, is it possible that Moshe also wrote, right, the preamble to the Esaret HaDibrot sometime after the Torah was given? The fundamental point being that what was given at Har Sinai is a much more limited set than what we might usually think. The more, even more intense question is how much editorial license did Moshe have? If Moshe's writing the Torah and he's writing it as he goes along, how much is it his decision to include what to include, to frame things a certain way, to order things a certain way? Right? Often, when drawing attention to the juxtaposition of certain verses or certain passages, or even the curious framing of certain things, we'll always refer to kind of amorphously the Torah, right? The Torah never wastes a word. That's how a classic, right? You want to open a Devar Torah, just start with the Torah never wastes a word and just wing it from there. That's like a classic way to open a Devar Torah, right? But generally, when we draw attention to juxtapositions and all these things, and we just say, the Torah arranged it this way, right? What exactly do we mean? Is there room in some sense to indicate Moshe's editorial license in consciously framing things certain ways in order to draw even greater attention to certain ideas found within the Torah? And here we turn, first of all, to again a Midrash in Shemot Rabbah. Very, very interesting Midrash. Davar Acher. This just proves the point I made earlier, by the way. Davar Acher, another matter. Right, so in this Midrash in Shemot Rabbah, there are like, and this is an exaggeration, but barely, 18,000 different interpretations of, right, God telling Moshe, Ktav lecha, write for yourself. This is, from my perspective, the most interesting of them, and it says the following, right? So God instructs Moshe to write the Torah. Hitchilu malachei hasharit. Omrim lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The ministering angels began to say before God, Atan notein reshut l'Moshe, you're giving permission to Moshe. Sheyichtov ma shehu mevakesh. He can write whatever he wants. Sheyomar liYisrael. You know, he's going to turn around to the Jewish people and say, Ani natati lochem et haTorah. I, Moshe, am the one who gave you the Torah. Ani hu shekatavti venatati lochem. I am the one who wrote it and gave it to them. I mean, this is, by the way, a really, really interesting midrash. Again, I don't want to get into open this bit of the Pandora's box, where there's a self-awareness on the part of the midrash that Moshe, as writer of the Torah, right, opens up all these questions about, right, like, how much license did he have? Right. However, God turns around in the Midrash. Amar lahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Chas v'shalom shemosha osa et hadavar hazeh. Right. God doesn't say God forbid. It would be a little bit confusing, but essentially God forbid that Moshe would do this. Va'afilu osa, and even if he were to, ne'emanhu, he's trustworthy. He's faithful. Shne'emar, lochein avdi Moshe, b'chol beiti ne'emanhu, as it says in the Torah, right? My servant Moshe, no one is more trustworthy than he. It's an incredible midrash. And again, so many of these sources could launch their own shiurim of the theological implications if we try and take them too far. And I don't want to get too distracted from all of those possible questions, but fundamentally there is this recognition, this acknowledgement that in this midrash, Moshe would not have used his editorial license, but had he done so, it's cool. He could do so because he was Moshe. He was allowed to. It's a very interesting, I can't think of the right, but it's like a very interesting covering bases kind of approach to this idea that Moshe had at least theoretical license and God was cool with that. God gave him that because he trusted Moshe. God trusted Moshe to arrange things the way he arranged things and he wasn't going to be upset or bothered by that fact. There is, and this is something I've quoted before, a really, really interesting perspective of the Chizkuni, who is one of the commentators, one of the medieval commentators, again, rooted in what was our source number one about how the Torah came to be. So Chizkuni is commenting on Sefer Shemot, and we read, right, Vaisavim et kol asher diber Hashem ito b'har Sinai. Moshe instructed them on everything God had told him at Har Sinai. And on this, the Chizkuni says, "Aval haTorah." And again, why he's prompted to discuss this here, right? But he is, "Aval haTorah Megillah Nitna." The Torah was given in pieces. Shelafi Shahaya Moshe Shomea Hamitzvot Mipi HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as Moshe would hear the commandments from God. Haya Kotev Kol Echat VeEchat BeMegilta LeAtzma. He would write each and every one in its own scroll. When he came to, when he was about to die, Sidor Sefer Torah. He organized, he arranged the Sefer Torah, the Keva Boha Parashiot, and he set its units ad hayom hazeh until this day, lefi hasmuchim haruyim lahem kamosha darshu rabotenu, just as kind of Chazal have understood and taught. His Kuni takes a hybrid approach to what we saw earlier. Right, earlier we saw two approaches mentioned by Rashi. One was Moshe wrote down everything and then he just sewed it all together. Right, that's a very, very simple second action. He just took his giant stack of parchment papers and he sewed them all together and is like, here's the Torah. The second view was only at the very, very end did he write them all down. Yizkuni presents a hybrid approach, which isn't just simply a hybrid approach, but actually inserts a new role for Moshe. Moshe wrote down everything, but then, after 40 years, he took everything out, and he was Sidor Sefer Torah, the Kavah Bo'ah Parsha. He arranged it, he edited it, he organized it. In other words, right, Moshe had a certain amount of editorial license here, and he decided, you know what, why does Parashat Ki Tisa appear between, you know, we could take this, I would say this is minimally controversial understanding of Chizkuni here, right? In a few weeks, not this Shabbos, but starting the next Shabbos, for 5 weeks, we'll read Truma and Tetzava, the instructions to build the Mishkan. We will then read Parashat Kitisa, the Chet HaEgal, and then we will read how the Jewish people built the Mishkan in Vayakhel and Pikudei. Right? Everyone always asks why. Why is it so repetitive? We get the instructions and then we get the actual building. Oh, and we also get Chet HaEgel slapped down in the middle. Right? What's going on here? Right? Per Chizkuni, that is an intentional editorial decision made by Moshe. Right? I am going to repeat, right, all of these details. That's what I'm going to include in the Torah. And I'm going to put Chet HaEgel in the middle, right? For reasons, whatever those reasons may be. It becomes a much more central role in the shaping of the Torah into the form that we have it to this day, per the Chizkuni. And similarly, and I would say this is the least likely source I would ever think to hint at this. And it's quoted by Mark Shapiro. So for those of you who were in town when we had Mark Shapiro as a scholar in residence, right? So Mark Shapiro, this is on the one hand, does him a disservice, but it's also kind of what makes him so amazing. Mark Shapiro has read everything, right? He will just read everything by everyone because he loves learning. And then he will be like, hey, so-and-so says something potentially controversial. If you link it up with all the other people who've said something about this, and no one else is reading half the stuff Mark Shapiro is reading, and definitely anyone else who is not reading it, you know, aware of kind of the broader questions and controversies. Which brings us to a sefer known as, we'll read it, Derech Sicha al HaTorah. Derech Sicha is conversations with Rav Chaim Kanievsky, one of the great, you know, Haredi Gedolim of the recent past, right? And, you know, it contains questions and answers. Someone, the author, put to Rav Kanievsky repeatedly that bothered him, and it has the questions and the answers. The question is prompted by source 11a. So in Sefer Bamidbar, we read, V'ha'ish Moshe anav ma'od. Now, Moshe was very humble. Mikol ha'adam, more than anyone else, asher al pnei adamah, upon the face of the earth. Now, if you look at that word in the Hebrew, I bolded it, anav, right? It's spelt aleph, nun, vav. Three letters. It should be spelt aleph, nun, yud, vav. Right? There should be a yud in there too. And this prompts the Or HaChaim, an 18th century commentator, to quote a midrash that is mentioned in the question in source 11b. So take a look at source 11b. She'ela. Bo'or HaChaim HaKadosh. Katav mi midrash. Right? It's written in a midrash. She'karnei hasod. She'karnei hahod. So at the end of Sefer Shemot, Moshe develops rays of light emanating from his face. Right. These rays of light, na'asu al yidei shiyor hadiyo shenatan al rosho. What did they come from? Right. So the Midrash says there was a little bit of ink left over from writing the Torah. Right. Obviously, this one, by the way, doesn't link up with some of the other things we've talked about, but ignore that fact. Right. There was a little bit of ink left over. Right. And it went on Moshe's forehead. Right. And that's what kind of turned into the rays of light emitting from Moshe's face. Where is that ink from? It's the yud in anav, right? He didn't write the yud, so there was a little bit of extra ink left on the quill, and that becomes, right, the source of his emanation, right? So the questioner continues in 11b. Shehakavana, the intent of this midrash, right? The yud of anav, Moshe removed it, right? The kavana ki Moshe meirov anava, right? Moshe was so humble. Lo katav v'ha'ish Moshe anav im yud. Moshe was so humble, he didn't want to write the fact that he was humble properly. V'lachin nish'ar yadio. And therefore there was ink left over. Right? It's a very nice, beautiful midrash. The questioner spots a theological problem with this midrash. By the way, you got to love, right? I mean, we've already read like lots of midrashim that spark a lot of theological issues, right? The questioner notes a theological problem with this. Right, Moshe was writing the Torah, and he removed a letter because he was so humble. V'zeh pele, v'chikatav eich sheyirtza. Harei kol ot haitam enavor. Moshe could write what he wanted. What, wasn't every letter supposed to be through prophecy? Right, if this midrash is true, that Moshe refused to write the letter yud, then Moshe was allowed to write things the way he wanted. How can that be? Right? We have a theological problem. That's the question put to Rav Chaim Kanievsky. The answer is very, very short. The answer is basically, yeah, it's no problem. That's fine. Moshe could do that. The answer is the following. Kishayotze bater. Similarly, right? Your question is good, but the truth is there are many examples like this. Katov ba'al haturim, right? The Torah writes the following. So another famous, well-known idea. Shekatov reish sefer vayikra. At the beginning of sefer vayikra, Shekatov alaf Zeirah, right? If you ever look in a Torah, I think they print this in most Chumashim too, right? The word Vayikra, God appeared to Moshe, the Aleph is written small. He ratzam Moshe lichtov Vayakar. Because Moshe wanted to write Vayakar, again, it's an expression of his humility, right? God just happened upon him, right? It's not that same relationship, right? Moshe didn't want to imply he had this close relationship with God. He just wanted to be like, God just stumbled across me one day, right? Vayakar. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but God turned around to him and said, Ketov im Aleph, no, write the Aleph. Aval, mikol makom katav ota bezi'ira. Right? So Moshe chose instead, right, he wrote the Aleph tiny to try and like preserve both his view and God's. And therefore it seems like, yeah, Moshe wasn't actually told how to write Vayikra. Right? Moshe had, right? So Rav Chaim Kanievsky is not doing what the Chizkuni does, and Moshe had broad license to arrange things, but letters, right? Moshe had the choice to write things the way he wanted. Right, the next time, right, you hear a Dvar Torah, why is this letter here or not here? Right, even Rav Chaim Kanievsky would allow the answer to be, Moshe just chose to do so. It was Moshe's editorial license to write it this way. Right, we see these ideas that do give a certain measure of editorial license to Moshe Rabbeinu. What that means in practice, I don't know. But what I do know is it means the notion is not as theologically terrifying as we might sometimes think. The most interesting of all the questions to ask is not what exactly was given at Har Sinai versus in other times, nor is it how much editorial license did Moshe have, but what on earth are we supposed to do with the verses that it seems impossible that Moshe wrote them? And the first person who always gets raised here is Ibn Ezra, because Ibn Ezra, more than anyone else, is famous for his view. And so we'll first look at Ibn Ezra's view, which emerges from the very, very end of the Torah, right? What happens at the end of the Torah? So chapter 34 of Sefer Devarim begins, Vaya'al Moshe me'arvot Moav har Nevo. Moshe ascended the steeps of Moav to har Nevo. Rosh ha-piskah al p'nei yirecho ve'yirosham et kol aris et gilad adan. Right? God shows him the whole land. Verse 5, Vayomot Sham Moshe, Evet Hashem Be'eretz Moav, Al Pi Hashem. Moshe died, the servant of God in the land of Moav, at the command of God. And the verses continue, right? There's 12 verses in this chapter. Theological quandary alert, right? How could if Moshe's writing the Torah, how could he write that he died? So famously, the Gemara in Bava Batra comes along and presents a few different opinions. Only one of which I want to highlight, right? There is another opinion that he wrote it in tears, right? He wrote it before he died, right? And it was filled in afterwards. But also where the Gemara in Bava Batra says, source number 13, Amar Mar, Yehoshua Katov Sifro. So in this part of Bava Batra, they're talking about who wrote what biblical book. So amidst this, Yehoshua Katov Sifro, right? Yehoshua wrote the book of Yehoshua. Makes sense. Ushmona Pesukim Shabbatorah, and also 8 verses in the Torah. Huh? Moshe didn't write these verses. No, Yehoshua did. Tanya, Commander Amar. We have a brighter that supports this idea. Shmona Pesukim Shabbatorah Yehoshua Katvan. Yehoshua wrote 8 verses in the Torah. The Tana Vayamat Sham Moshe Evet Hashem. Moshe died there, the servant of God. Efshar Moshe mate. How could Moshe die? V'chatav Vayamat Sham Moshe, and yet write and Moshe died. Ela Adkan Katav Moshe. Moshe wrote up until this point in the Torah. Mikan ve'elech katav Yehoshua. Yehoshua wrote the final verses of the Torah, Divrei Rabbi Yehuda, v'amri la Rabbi Nechemia, right? It's either the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda or Rabbi Nechemia. Right? Chazal themselves are open to the idea that these impossible verses to have been written by Moshe were written by Moshe. They propose Yehoshua instead. Along comes Ibn Ezra. And right, Ibn Ezra, and we spoke about this, we've been speaking on Friday nights for people who don't come out on Friday nights for one reason or another, right? We've been talking about the various commentators and their methodologies and all of these various different things, right? And Ibn Ezra, right, is known for the fact that, right, he likes to explain the literal meaning of the verses, and he is, especially when it comes to non-halachic matters. Halachic matters are a separate conversation, but when it comes to narratives, Ibn Ezra never has any problem explaining a narrative in what he believes to be the most sensible way, regardless of how it has been understood until that point. And thus, Ibn Ezra comes along, already on the first verse, and says the following, Vaya'al Moshe, Lefi da'ati, according to me, I believe, ki mizeh, from this mizeh ha-pasuk, this verse already, verse number one, of chapter 34 of Sefer Devarim, Katav Yehoshua. Yehoshua already wrote at this point, Ki achar sha'ala Moshe lo katav. Because once Moshe had ascended, he wasn't writing anymore. Uvederech nevua katvu, and Yehoshua wrote it through prophecy. In other words, Yehoshua just turns around and says, Ibn Ezra just turns around and says, right, given verse 1 already begins with Moshe ascending the mountain, right? No, we can't. And how did he know what happened, right? He was a prophet, right? That's the important point also. That's how he knows how it happens. But basically, just before Moshe is about to ascend the mountain, right, he leaves ink, quill, scrolls with Yehoshua and he goes up, as opposed to chucking them down in the mountain just before he's about to die so Yehoshua can catch them and write it. But fundamentally, right, Ibn Ezra extends it to all 12 verses of the final chapter of Sefer Devarim. But then Ibn Ezra goes one step further. And he is commenting on a verse in the very, very beginning, and by at the very, very beginning, the opening verse of Sefer Devarim, which says the following. Eila ha-Devarim. These are the words, Asher Diber Moshe al Kol Yisrael, that Moshe said to the Jewish people, Be'eva ha-Yardain, on the other side of the Jordan, Ba'midbar ba'arvam al-Suf bein Paran u'bein Tovel, V'lavan v'chatzerot v'dizahav. Right, that's the location. There is, and this occurs several times in the Torah in Sefer Devarim, there is a glaring theological issue with this verse. Be'eva ha-Yardain, on the other side of the Jordan. Moshe said this on the other side of the Jordan. Where does Moshe say it? Moshe says it outside of the land of Israel. What's on the other side of the Jordan? Well, Israel and outside of Israel are either side of the Jordan. And if you're referring to where Moshe is speaking to as the other side of the Jordan, that means you are in Israel. In other words, this verse implies that it is being written at a time when the Jews are already in the land of Israel, right? These were the words Moshe spoke on the other side of the Jordan, back over there, before we'd crossed into the land. What are we to do with that? The Torah is given, right, on that side of the Jordan. So how can we be referencing the other side, right? It's all other side of the Jordan. I'm trying to use it to describe two different things, but you get the point. It's a huge problem. I needed a map. I didn't bring a map. But the point is, you get the idea, right? It is implying Moshe wrote this over there, outside of Israel. We are in Israel at this time. Moshe spoke this on the other side, outside of Israel. Commenting on this, Ibn Ezra says the following. Ve'im tavin, Sod Hashnei Masar, if you understand the secret of the 12, Gam, you will also understand the following. Right? And Ibn Ezra gives us, and in the English I have the full verses, whereas he just gives us the opening words in the Hebrew. Right? So you'll also read, Vayichtov Moshe, that day Moshe wrote down. In other words, again, it doesn't sound like it's happening at that moment. V'haknaani az ba'aretz, the most famous of all the examples, right, in Sefer Bereshit, right, Avraham passes through the land, and then the Torah tells us that was when the Kana'anim lived there. In other words, it's assuming its audience live in a world where the Kana'anim no longer live there, they've been eradicated, i.e. the Jews are already living in the land of Israel and they've eradicated the Kana'anim, but the Torah is reminding us, oh, the Kana'anim still lived there back in those days. In other words, it looks like it's been written in the future. Right, Bahar Hashem Yireh. Right, this is from Akedat Yitzchak. Right, and Avraham named the site, right, Hashem Yireh. Hence the saying, you know, on the Mount of God there is a vision. Right, like it references a saying, like a popular phrase saying, which did not exist at the time Avraham did Akedat Yitzchak. Right, the popular saying happened at another point. And finally, Vihine Arsho Eres Bazel. So it's talking about Og being the remaining of the Rephaim of the giants, and it tells us, right, his bedstead is now in another location, right? And again, that can't be contemporaneous with Sefer Devarim. Right, so Ibn Ezra says, if you understand the secret of the 12, you will also understand all of these other verses. Takir ha'emet, you will understand the truth. What is the secret of the 12? The 12 verses of the final chapter of Sefer Devarim. The final verses of the Torah, which Ibn Ezra believes were not written by Moshe. Ibn Ezra hints, but nonetheless believes that there were certain glosses added to the Torah, like reference points, waypoints, added at a later point through Nevuah, right? And again, it's important to note, none of these verses are, by the way, theologically significant in any sense. It's not like he's saying, eat the Korban Pesach was added later. No, that's not one of his verses, because there's no need for it to be. But there are certain verses where there's almost an orienting or orientating, depending on the country you're from. There are words there to orient your reading, to better understand things, right? Just like parenthetical comments. And Ibn Ezra argues that in all of these cases, these parenthetical comments come after the Torah, right? They were added in after the Torah was given, right? To help a reader understand what was going on, right? All of these verses, or these phrases within verses, were added. That is Ibn Ezra's, right? Fascinating position on the verses of the Torah that don't make sense for Moshe to have written them. However, as fascinating as Ibn Ezra is, they have absolutely nothing on Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid. Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, right? So it's always important to remember, right? The word chassid or chassid or pious, right? Nowadays, most popularly refers to a, right, late 1700s movement of Jews with a very, very specific theological focus marked by beards and hats, at least for the men, right? Chassidim. However, historically, chassid referred to something else, which was the Chassidei Ashkenaz. Right, this pietistic movement in the medieval world, in Germany, in those sorts of areas, right? They were really into Kabbalah, they were really into asceticism, right? And Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid is basically the greatest of all of them, right? He is the author of Sefer Hasidim, a medieval work, right? He's the teacher of the Rokeach, one of the most influential also rabbis, all of which is to say Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid is one of the firmest men to have ever lived. But boy, did he have interesting perspectives on the Torah. Now, in a few moments, we will be reading from Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid's commentary to the Torah, which famously Rav Moshe Feinstein forbade the publication of, because how can we publish things that make Yehuda HaChassid a heretic? Just going to throw that out there, right? Like, there is the reaction to Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid's Torah commentary was written by his son, but still, his son was also one of the Chassidei Ashkenaz, right? But the perspective basically is, if Rav Yehuda HaChassid can't have said this because it's heresy, therefore it must be wrong, it must be incorrect, you can't publish it. But, right, and this is again something Mark Shapiro does very well, other people do it very well too, if you have the patience to read Chassidei Ashkenaz's perspectives on the Torah, it's actually a huge recurring theme, right? Their incredible willingness to interpret verses in the most bizarre way. And there are two examples I want to share. The first, I think, I don't know how long it took me to wrap my head around, and I feel like I got a migraine in the middle of it. So we're going to hopefully take it, either we're going to take it quickly because I'll remember it as I'm saying it, or alternatively we'll take it slowly. But it's the following. In Sefer Bamidbar, in Parashat Maaseh, we read the following. When the Jewish people are traveling, Vayis'u me'Avrona, they set off from Avrona, vayachanu be'Etzion Gaver, and they arrived in a place called Etzion Gaver. Fine. Etzion Gaver, to 99.9% of people who read the Torah, let's be honest, when was the last time anyone paid attention to Parashat Maaseh? Location, location. They went from location A to location B. They went from location B to location C. But Reb Yehuda HaChassid was more serious than most. And so he paid attention to these names. And he spotted an issue with Etzion Gaver. What's the problem with Etzion Gaver? Well, if we look in Divrei Hayamim, this bet, we read the following: As halach Shlomo le'Etzion Gaver. Shlomo went to Etzion Gaver, ve'el Eilot al Svat Hayam be'eretz Edom. He went to Etzion Gaver and other places in the land of Edom. This is a problem with a capital P for reasons that do not appear obvious at first, which is that the territory of Edom does not belong to the Jewish people, and the Torah is very insistent about basically traveling around there. Right? Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid is really, really bothered by how could the Jewish people have settled in, have encamped in a place, right, that they weren't supposed to be in the territory of Edom? Right? How can it be? Right? The Torah tells us Etzion Gaver was in a territory of a people the Jewish people were not supposed to be in. What to make of this? So before we look at Rav Yehuda HaChassid's comment itself, right, there is a final verse to note. And I'm going to explain how Rav Yehuda HaChassid understands this verse. It's from the end of Parashat Vayishlach, where it's talking about Esav and his descendants, and therefore Edom. And again, it's another one of these genealogical lists no one pays attention to except Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, and he says the following. Right, so the verse says, Vayomot Baal Hanan ben Achbor, Vayimloch Tachtav Hadar, Shem Iro Pau. Right, so Baal Hanan, the son of Achbor, passed away, and he was succeeded by Hadar. And Hadar's city was Pau. And then, unusually, the Torah also tells us, Vishem Ishto. The wife of Hadar, we don't really get wives' names in this list, right? The wife's name was Mehetav El Bat Matred Bat Mezahav, right? Her name was Mehetav El, who was the daughter of Matred, who was the daughter of Mezahav, right? We get a daughter of a woman who's a daughter of a man. That was a very weird way of phrasing it, but what Reb Yehuda HaChassid understands here to be is the following. Verse 39 is teaching us about a political alliance. And Etzion Gaver, right? Again, there's a lot more to this that I'm not simplifying it, but I'm just not dealing with a bunch of additional points to the argument. Etzion Gaver belonged to Mehetavel, right? That belonged to her family. But because she was the daughter of a daughter, it passed to Hadar through marriage. In other words, Etzion Gaver does not become part of Edom until after the Jewish people have, way after the Jewish people were there in Parashat Maaseh. Bear that in mind as we read Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid's point. It will make a little bit more sense as we read Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid. And again, there's no digitized Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid. This is pulled from the book. Right, so he talks about this issue. Etzion Gaver was not a problem during the days of Moshe. Ki im lifnei melach melach livnei Yisrael. Because, and he quotes a verse earlier in Sefer Bereshit, in introducing the kings of Edom, it says, all these kings reigned before there was a king amidst the Jewish people. Ibn Ezra would have a field day with that verse, by the way. But right, until before that, all these kings reigned before there was a king amidst the Jewish people. Pirush, in other words, Kodem Shamaloch Shaul Acharehen. Right, in other words, Etzion Gaver, right, is given before the Jew, after the Jewish people have traveled through it. It doesn't become Edom until then. Aval bimei Shlomo kvar naaseh. But by Shlomo, this had already happened. Lochein. And by the way, if nothing until this point has made sense, don't worry. Because ultimately, it's the next line that's crucial for our purposes. Lochain, therefore, Katvu bime Knesset Gdola Bechumash. In the days of the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, the men of the Great Assembly. In other words, much, 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 much later on in Jewish history, right? Temple times. In those days, they wrote it in the Chumash. So that when someone else is reading, how could Etzion Gever? How could the Jewish people be in Etzion Gever? It makes no sense. No, 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 no. The Anshei Knesset Hagdola says Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid. And you wonder why Rav Moshe Feinstein wanted to ban this book from being published, right? Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, one of the greatest rabbis to have ever lived, says this verse here. Whether or not, again, anyone makes sense of that argument, again, it's very confusing. Give me my migraine. I did my best job. The Anshei Knesset Hagdola inserted this verse into the Torah. Completely sanguine about it, Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, the men of the Great Assembly were just, you know, they just added a verse to help everyone. Right? This is not now Yehoshua through Nevuah. This is not prophecy. This is, right, and the Anshei Knesset Hagdola are still very, very important people. But Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid has no issue whatsoever with the idea that navigating verses were added later into the Torah. The most crazy of all Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid's ideas, and it's not actually 100% related to our point, and again, I should stress, right, Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid uses the Anshei Knesset Hagdola argument in several places. This was the one that was easiest to explain, by the way. Just if you wonder, like, you know, like his book is not like light reading on a Shabbat afternoon, right? If you can find it and read it, it's still impossible to understand, but, right, this was the one that was the easiest to explain, and I did my best, and it was still tough, and I probably didn't explain it very well. But Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid is happy to invoke the idea that the Anshei Knesset Hagdola included these navigating verses. Even more crazily still, however, is another view of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, which builds off Parashat Chukat. Right? The verse says, As Yashir Yisrael at Hashira Hazot, right, then the Jewish people sung the following in appreciation of the well. Alei ve'er enula, a well, sing to it. And then the next verse, right? Be'er chafura sarim karona divei ha'am, right? They dug it, right? The people built it, made it with maces, b'mishan altam, with their own staff, umamidbar, and then they continue, you know, and, right, it starts talking about journeys again. The Parashat Chukat tells us the Jewish people sang a song. But doesn't actually, it's not like in Parashat Beshalach, where we get the whole song, right? The song is missing, right? The song, verse 17 through verse 18, verse 17 tells us a song was sung by the Jewish people. One answer, by the way, is just this four words. But no, the assumption is, right, there's a song here that the Torah doesn't tell us. So Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid decides he has an answer to this. That's just madness. And he says the following. As Yashir, Yisrael atashira hazot, perish mori avi. Right, so again, it's his son, so my father and teacher explained the following. Zehu halel hagadol. This is the great halel. Shela achar shenitzlu misichon va'og va'avru nachal arnon. Right, that after they were saved from Sichon, from Og, and they crossed the nachal arnon, as Na'ase Zehashir, right? Great Hallel is Psalm 136, right? Then that, it's the Hodu in Psukkah Dezimra on Shabbos, right? And also in, we just say on Seder night too, right? Then that was when that Shir was sung. U'bachumash Hayakativ, and it was written in the Chumash. It used to be, if you would have opened up a Chumash in the past, or in this case, a Torah scroll, if you would have taken a Torah scroll, in the days of Yehoshua and opened up to Parashat Chukat, you would have found Psalm 136 found within. Ella, David HaMelech, kol hisir kol mizmorei yat meshel Moshe shebechumish v'chivran b'sefer tehillim. Shelo. But what did David HaMelech do? He took it out and he put it in Sefer Tehillim. Right? A bunch of the things Moshe wrote, right? We also have Tefillah LeMoshe Esh HaElokei, right? We do have a psalm in the name of Moshe. But Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid argues that David HaMelech took out Pesukim from the Torah. and put them in Sefer Tehillim. The kicks and giggles, right? Because he wanted them in there, right? Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid's willingness to entertain some of the most theologically extreme positions has no bounds. Men of the Great Assembly wrote them, included verses. David HaMelech took out verses to include in Tehillim. It's madness. And I want to talk about what I would say is, in the broad strokes, the theological implications of all of this in a moment. But first, I want to just share a view of Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik. It's a long one, but it's worth reading out loud. So Chaim Soloveitchik, right, is the son of Rav Soloveitchik, a huge Talmud Chacham, a professor of Jewish history who has, like, a lot of what he writes is brilliant. And he talks about a lot of these issues we've just discussed in the latter half of this year. And he writes the following. One Tana had stated, right, that's in the Gemara, simply and with no ado, that the last eight verses were of divine origin, but not of Mosaic authorship. And Rev Yehuda HaChassid added that there were several more verses that were not penned by Moses. Was such a position seen as being thoroughly mistaken? Most probably. Was it viewed as odd and nonconformist? Undoubtedly. Though hardly more eccentric than Rev Yehuda's view that King David, to flesh out his book of Psalms, lifted from the text of the original Pentateuch many anonymous Psalms that Moshe had penned. Were these strange and misguided views, however, perceived as being in any way heretical or even dangerous? At that time and place, certainly not. They contained no concession to the Rassan around in culture, opened no Pandora's box of questions. Indeed, one can take the religious temperature of Rev Yehuda HaChassid's explanation by the matter-of-fact way European medieval commentators treated the passages in Menachot and Bava Batra, where the Tanaitic dictum of Yehoshua's authorship is brought. In their world, these words did not abut any slippery slope of a documentary hypothesis or of Jewish forgery. No need, therefore, to reinterpret this passage or to forfend any untoward implications. What concerned Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid's contemporaries, the Tosafists, in this statement were its practical halachic implications for Shabbat Torah reading, not its theological or dogmatic ones, for to them, as to Rabbi Yehuda, there were none. What he's saying here, first and foremost, is that rabbis in the medieval world, they had no skin in the theological game. Right? They didn't have theological challenges coming from biblical criticism that they were trying to ward off that they were bothered by. And so not a single one of them is like, we get so interested in this idea that, like, Yehoshua wrote the final verses of the Torah. But, like, it's a very new thing to find that fascinating. In the medieval world, they were just like, yeah, sure. It didn't theologically rattle their cages, right? Rev Yehuda HaChassid lived in a world where one was free to say these very outlandish ideas, and you weren't a heretic, you just had an outlandish idea, right? The theological stakes were very, very different. There is an argument, right? And I've seen different arguments in favor and against this argument. The Ibn Ezra writes secretly, right? He's much more kind of conservative in how he frames things, because in the Sephardi world, they were slightly more theologically conscious of these things, and so we could only hint at them, whereas in the Ashkenazi world, they didn't have those same issues, so Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid could write explicitly. But the point is, right, we shouldn't take too much shock from these medieval commentators, because they lived in a world where these ideas weren't crazy. They were just outlandish and strange. But they weren't bothered by things. They believed in the Torah, but they didn't really worry too much about the theological implications of what exactly that meant. Only nowadays, confronted by biblical criticism, confronted by academic scholarship, do we have to start asking, what does all of this mean? And that's when Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid's views are either fascinating to embrace, at least in theory, because they open up, right, worlds of theological possibility, or alternatively are a threat because they risk conceding a point to those people who would attack religiosity. And that's what's so fascinating about, right, Chaim Soloveitchik's position and perspective here is just, right, in the medieval world, they didn't care. There were no theological stakes attached to this, much as in the same way, and I mentioned this, if not in the first year, then the second, right? Like all of these things that nowadays are seen as perfect examples of biblical criticism are just taken by Chazal and Rishonim in their stride because they didn't think twice about them, right? Their theological issues were with very, very different ideas. Their theological problems were with fundamentally different issues than what we are confronted with nowadays. And so in the medieval world, there was a surprising latitude, at least with some commentators, in the opinions they would advance, right? And even if we extended a little bit more, right? Ramban is happy to criticize the Avot. He's happy to criticize Avraham, right? Like all of these things that nowadays are theologically, you know, sensitive. In the medieval world, no one was bothered by these things because they had different states. What I do want to conclude with very, very briefly is, right, to touch on what I would say is the theological thrust of what I've been trying to illustrate, particularly tonight. Absent Rabbi Mordechai Breuer, right, who does embrace biblical scholarship, as we talked about in the first week, right, it is hard to marry biblical scholarship with traditional Judaism. But the threat of biblical scholarship should not make us afraid to ask, what do we actually believe? And how much latitude is there in what it is that we are supposed to believe when it comes to the Torah, right? We should not be afraid, and instead we should almost pick up the mantle and ask, you know, what do we believe? None of these views challenge, right, ultimately our practice as Jews. None of these views actually challenge the important things, but right, they do complicate and nuance in interesting ways, right? Our understanding of the Torah. And I would say there's two perspectives to almost take. One is to embrace, right? One is to say, I really enjoy the idea of a much more broad, nuanced understanding of when the Torah was given and how it came to be, right? The other alternative approach, and this is the approach I often think about in this realm and with a lot of philosophical issues, and the analogy I've been using now for years upon years upon years upon years. It's one of the first analogies I ever came up with before I was even a rabbi and I was giving a share on another topic. And the analogy I always, which is not by the way to say it's a good analogy, it's just to say, as someone with a lot of bad analogies, this was either the first bad one or the last good one. But I like to think sometimes of our theology. Picture the way you build a house, right? You can build as many beautiful rooms as possible. You can build as many floors. You can make things as nice as you want. But at the end of the day, you need foundations for the house to stay upright. And those foundations are rarely pretty, right? Those, it would be a waste of money to make them pretty, right? They're just concrete. There's nothing particularly exciting about them. You're not showing the foundations off, but they are the entire structure upon which the house stands. It is important sometimes to be aware of the potential latitude Jewish thought has for some of these major theological questions. Because even if you're not going to embrace full on Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid's view every day and every night now, for as long as you live, right? The simple fact that there was one of the greatest rabbis who had ever lived, who, when he met a verse that didn't make sense to him, sometimes had the most outlandish of interpretations possible to understanding it, right? He was happy to go in a surprisingly strange number of directions to work with it, right? That idea, right, need not be the main idea of belief, but it's good to have at the foundation, because fundamentally, right, when it comes to the things that we believe, knowing that there is that latitude underneath, knowing that there is actually possibilities for broader understandings, ultimately strengthens our theological beliefs. We can less fearfully encounter some of these ideas within biblical scholarship. We can encounter some of these more controversial ideas without the same level of fear or sense of threat. When we realize, when we know, right, there's probably someone in the medieval world, in the Hasidei Ashkenaz, who already said that Because chances are there are, with a surprising number of verses, someone in Chasidei Ashkenaz said something crazy about it. And so I think, right, again, there is so much more we could say. So many books have been written, right? Rav Bazak's Ad Hayom Hazeh. I'm now holding it up to the screen in case I didn't do this in the first week. Rav Bazak's Ad Hayom Hazeh, from which a lot of these things have been culled. You have Josh Berman's Anima Amin, right? Also by Koren. You have the Revelation at Sinai, which is sometimes available for like $4 on Amazon. I bought it at full price and I'm filled with regret, right? All of these books that exist out there that have grappled with biblical scholarship for some reason or another, and there are so many others again. But it's also an opportunity for us to reframe and re-understand exactly what we do believe, and to understand that maybe there are different layers to our belief system. And at the bottom of those layers can be some of the more outlandish ones that provide ultimately a much stronger structure for our belief and a much greater platform upon which we can build, so much more of our theology. But it is fundamentally crucial to understand and realize that most of the things that theologically shock us probably were already dealt with and were surprisingly often answered in a more outlandish way than we could ever imagined by one of the Hasidei Ashkenaz, by one of the Rishonim, by one of the Acharonim. Sometimes all that we need to do is actually pick up a sefer and learn through it, and then we will actually have illuminated before us, right, a tighter theological position than we ever thought possible.